Welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on this Sunday, July 26th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Taking a look at today's front page, Iowa Death's Top Grim Forecast. This is reported by Aaron Jordan and Sarah Watson. On July 16th, Iowa's coronavirus deaths hit 777, a toll that, when predicted in late March, seemed impossibly grim and was questioned by Governor Kim Reynolds. Now, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, a research center at the University of Washington, predicts between 1,100 and 1,800 Iowans will die from COVID-19 by November 1st, with the lower number possible only if Iowans wear masks in public places, said Abraham Flaxman, an associate professor of health metrics science with the Institute. If everyone started wearing masks, that would turn this curve around. As part of its state-by-state projections, which drew attention from the White House Coronavirus Task Force, the Institute predicted May 31st that 777 Iowans would die from COVID-19 by August 4th. Iowa actually hit that number earlier, July 16th. And as Saturday, 826 Iowans have died because of the virus. To put that into perspective, it's more than double the number of people who died in car crashes in Iowa for all of 2019, and nearly three times the number of Iowans who died from influenza in the 2017-2018 flu season, one of the worst in recent history, according to the Des Moines Register. Someone who knows Iowa's COVID-19 deaths are more than just numbers is Marlene Kremasta, who lost her husband Stephen to the disease April 22nd. Stephen Kremasta, 61, was one of at least 26 residents of Heritage Specialty Care in Cedar Rapids to die from COVID-19 as part of an outbreak at the center that affected at least 114 residents and staff. Marlene Kremasta said he had a temperature on the 30th of March. He went to the hospital March 31st. They put him immediately on a ventilator. The readers then directed to an inside page for the continuation of the story. The story does not appear anywhere else in the paper, so that's the end of the top story. Another story on the front page, Smooth Ride, Bumpy Future, is reported by Tim Jamieson from Waterloo. A dedicated local option sales task has given Waterloo the best streets among Iowa's largest communities. But a new report commissioned by the city found road conditions will take a turn for the worse soon if more money isn't earmarked for major repairs. The city council hired H.R. Green Incorporated of Cedar Rapids last year to evaluate the city's current street funding and repair process. The consultant noted Waterloo's average street condition ranks tops among the state's 10 largest cities based on 2018 data collected by the Iowa Department of Transportation through the Institute for Transportation at Iowa State University. A 1% local option sales tax for street repairs approved by voters since 1991 and above average use of asphalt road surfaces were cited as key reasons for the city scoring a 70.4 pavement condition index rating. Council Bluffs and Iowa City were the only other major cities averaging over 60 on the scale that runs from 0 to 100. Waterloo's high ranking may surprise many motorists familiar with a few of the city's rougher roads, but Mayor Quentin Hart wasn't shocked. "I'm not surprised by this rating," Hart said. "We are happy to see that the efforts of our staff and investments to street have gained the long-needed recognition in comparison to other cities. Although this is the case, we still have a tremendous amount of work to do," he added. "We have several street overlay and reconstruction projects that are valuable to a long-range future of this community. The city has been receiving about $10 million each year in local option sales tax revenue to repair its 420 miles of streets. Roughly $6.5 million is spent on annual reconstruction and overlay contracts, which respectively involve completely rebuilding failing roads and putting down a new asphalt surface to extend their lives. Another $900,000 is used to put a seal coat on streets that were previously gravel surfaces. The remaining local option revenues cover salaries of engineers working on the program and provides matching funds for the construction of new roads, primarily serving economic development projects. H.R. Green was retained to inventory the streets, develop maintenance schedules, evaluate funding, and set up a plan detailing which streets should be repaired over the next 7 years. But the firm said a lack of growth in sales tax receipts coupled with rising construction costs will cause Waterloo's average street condition to begin deteriorating. The findings of the investigation determined that the current construction budget of approximately $7.5 million may not be sufficient based on long-term sustainability, according to H.R. Green's report. It continued, spending has been relatively flat the past 5 years, and revenue growth has been below the inflation rate. This means that while the budget is likely more than sufficient right now, it will slowly lose its purchasing power, and less work will be completed for the same amount in future years. H.R. Green indicated the first funding hurdle is expected in 2026. The model shows Waterloo would need an increase of $3 million annually, or a one-time $80 million bonding effort, to keep the average road condition steady over the next 15 years. Put another way, the study said it would take an estimated $182 million today to bring all Waterloo streets up to very good condition. Based on current funding levels, that gap is expected to grow to $318 million by 2034. But the study said keeping the current funding formula would not be disastrous. The report stated, in fact, if no changes to funding occur in the next 15 years, Waterloo would still have a higher average condition score than nearly every other major metropolitan area in the state currently. The report comes at a time when city policymakers have talked about dividing the local option tax revenue for other uses. Several council members during the last budget process suggested asking voters for permission to switch a portion of the revenue from street repairs to provide property tax relief. Hart said he still believed reallocating some of the sales tax money could be a viable option. If we propose shifting some funds, I would cap that amount to make sure that we continue working on roads but are able to provide some property tax for residents, he said. Other communities use these dollars for special projects, blight elimination, or direct property tax relief. In comparison, Waterloo is one of very few of the top 10 largest cities that don't use local option for property tax relief directly, he added. We will have to analyze any impacts and its positive impact on the city. Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Cedar Rapids are the only communities among the state's 15 most populous cities that use local option tax entirely for street repairs, while Council Bluffs covers streets and sewers. Des Moines, Ames, Sioux City, Dubuque, Davenport, Dubuque, West Des Moines, and Urbandale all dedicate at least half their local option tax money for property tax relief. City engineer Jamie Knudsen said he plans to hold a city council work session in the future to discuss the findings of the H.R. Green report. The COVID-19 pandemic has put the meeting on the back burner. The article is highlighted by a picture on the front page of a large asphalt laying machine as it lays a section on 3rd Street in Waterloo on Wednesday. And a third story on the front page, a mission to catalog mask rules at local businesses. This is reported by Amy Rivers. Kate Washut and her husband love going out to eat in the Cedar Valley. The Cedar Falls couple didn't quit that habit when the coronavirus hit, continuing to visit favorite restaurants and coffee shops for curbside pickup and delivery after Kim Reynolds temporarily restricted sit-down dining. But when places started opening back up, Washut started to question whether continuing to go out as she normally did, particularly in Black Hawk County's coronavirus numbers climbed, was a smart decision. Washut said, "My husband is in the high-risk category for coronavirus complications, so it was really important for us to lower our risk to the virus. Because each restaurant sets its own mask, social distancing, and sanitation guidelines, Washut wasn't sure which ones would be able to accommodate their preferences for safety." She said, "I was just really frustrated not knowing what our options were." A couple of weeks ago, Washut started contacting her favorite restaurants to ask them what their policies are, and sharing the information with her Facebook friends who were also looking for such establishments. She said, "People started reacting to it, thanking me for it." Another person in the Cedar Rapids area said he had created a Facebook group and a Google Doc with what they were finding. Washut decided she'd try the same thing. It sounded like a pretty easy way to crowdsource, she said. She began the Facebook group Cedar Valley Restaurant / Retail Mask Policies and attached a publicly available Google Doc where she added what she had found so far in Cedar Falls, Waterloo, and Waverly. The group had more than 1,200 members as of Thursday afternoon. "Man, it really blew up," Washut said of the group's popularity. "People really appreciate it. They're really passionate about the safety of our community." The Google Doc includes information on whether each business's employees are masked, whether they have outdoor dining or curbside pickup, whether customer masks are required or encouraged, and whether indoor seating is arranged for social distancing. There's also a space for comments where people can add other information about each business, such as whether hand sanitizer is available or if appointments are required. She said all those things factor into people's decision-making. Washut continues to do the bulk of updating the document when she's not working at the software company she owns, Far Reach in Cedar Rapids, but others have started contributing information as well. Business owners have added their policies to the Google Doc, and customers have commented in the group about their experiences. Information from different people on a particular business doesn't always match. Somebody will go to a store and have one experience, someone else on a different day will have a different experience. In the spreadsheet I try to highlight, there's not a consensus, she said. Nearly 100 eateries and 60 retail establishments in the area have been added so far, plus around 30 other places like gyms, salons, tattoo parlors, and libraries. Washut said she's trying to keep the group apolitical, even posting a reminder on the page Thursday about keeping political commentary out. "I sort of doubt that people who are not on the board with wearing masks, they're probably not even joining," she said. Ultimately, she sees the group as a handy resource for those looking for a low-risk dining or shopping experience in the Cedar Valley. She said, Washut said of the pandemic, "Nobody knows where this thing is going. It's been very unpredictable and up and down. So if there's something I can do to help people make decisions that help keep them safe, I'm happy to do it." From the group's Google Doc, here's a list of the Cedar Valley businesses Washut and others say have mask mandates or at least encourage masks for both employees and customers. And I'll read the list. From Cedar Falls, Aldi, American Eagle, Bike Tech, Brown's Shoes, Cedar Falls Rec Center, CVS, Dollar Tree, Eclipse Hair Studio, Family Dollar, Ginger Thai, Hall Bicycle, Hatchlings and Hens, Hertz Donuts, Hy-Vee, Jiva Salon Spa, Kate and Company Salon and Spa, KJ and Company, Kohl's, Menards, Metro Records, Miss Wonderful, Natural Grocers, Panera Bread, Peekaboo Baby, Pura Vida Salon, Red Owl Tattoo, Salon Iris, Salon Zola, Scratch Cupcakery, Starbucks, Sub City, College Hill, Target, Texture Salon, Three Pines Farm, Trinkets and Togs, Viridian Credit Union, Walgreens, Walmart, West Music, Wolf Eye Clinic, and World's Window. In Waterloo, she lists on the website Aldi, Amosan Chiropractic, Barnes & Noble, Bed Bath & Beyond, Best Buy, Cedar Valley Bicycle Collective, CVS, Den Herder Veterinary Hospital, Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, Greenfields Health Center, Hair Gallery, Home Depot, Hy-Vee, Knox Eye Care, LA Nails, Lowe's, Menards, Noodles & Company, Panera Bread, PetSmart, Ridgeway Dental, Sam's Club, Scratch Cupcakery, Starbucks, Stuff Etc., Target, TJ Maxx, Tractor Supply Company, Trends Hair Salon, Trio Salon Spa, Viridian Credit Union, Walgreens, Walmart, Waterloo Public Library, Waterloo Urban Farmers Market. The article is accompanied by a picture of the person conducting the survey, Kate Washit. In the Cedar Valley section, Waterloo discusses downtown parking changes. Reported by Tim Jamieson, city council members are expected this week to continue debating whether to allow some free downtown parking. The council has scheduled a work session for 3:40 p.m. Monday to discuss the issue, which has picked up steam after downtown merchants, hurt by the COVID-19 pandemic, said parking meters keep them at a disadvantage. Councilmen Pat Morrissey and Dave Boson last week both indicated they supported allowing a free parking period of 1 to 2 hours on East 4th Street and possibly on side streets. But others raised concerns that allowing free parking would shift the cost burden from parking users onto property taxpayers citywide. Waterloo received about $500,000 in parking revenue during the 2019 fiscal year, which included $156,000 from meters and another $100,000 in fines. The rest came from daily and monthly parking ramp use. The city annually attempts to keep the operating budget for downtown parking from requiring a subsidy, although property taxpayers do help support major repairs to the parking ramp. The city also would need to work with its downtown parking contractor, Republic Parking, on ways to enforce a free time limit to ensure downtown workers or residents don't take up the available on-street parking. Mayor Quentin Hart said he was working with Main Street Waterloo on possible grab-and-go zones that would allow people picking up items or food from a downtown business to park free for 15 minutes. The issue is slated as a work session. Any final decision on parking changes would need to be approved during a regular meeting in the future. The regular meeting is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. Monday in the council chambers of City Hall. Some council members will be attending electronically, and residents wishing to comment on items are encouraged to do so via email to the city clerk's office or contact the clerk to get login information to participate in the meeting by phone or Zoom meeting. Now we turn to the opinion page for the Courier editorial, which is headed by a cartoon titled Math Class. It shows the picture of a boy student sitting face on with a desk and seemingly taking a test. And the text of the test is, Tommy goes to school on a school bus with 30 students and attends 6 classes with an average of 22 students in each class. How many people has Tommy infected? The title of the editorial is Education System Faces Hardest Test. The U.S. education system is facing its biggest test yet this fall, and possibly beyond, in finding a balance between promoting learning and reducing the risk of spreading the coronavirus. It's a balancing act featuring three options: returning to regular classrooms, reverting to remote learning, or a hybrid, with in-person attendance rotating with home studies. President Donald Trump, Governor Kim Reynolds, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine are among those calling for in-person instruction rather than remote learning. The pediatricians want schools, quote, physically present in school, students. They want the students physically present in school as much as possible because of health, major health, social, and educational risks to keeping them at home, including potential abuse. Remote classes don't work for many children, particularly minorities, unlikely to have access to computers or Wi-Fi. Harvard and Brown researchers found that among 800,000 students using the Zoom online math program, those in high-income zip codes maintained progress. Those in middle-income zip codes declined by a third, and it was half in lower-income zip codes. And many parents aren't able to stay home to provide or monitor progress. But in-person learning has complications, including whether to wear masks, classroom sizes, and physical distancing, including lunch, recess, hallway traffic, and busing. While students under 10 are much less susceptible to COVID-19, they aren't immune, according to a South Korean study. If asymptomatic, they could infect unsuspecting family members and teachers. Studies have shown that students ages 10 to 19 have the same capacity to contract the disease as adults. Teachers have issues too, particularly the 28% nationwide in the high-risk group over 50. Surveys indicate a third of teachers don't want to return to classrooms. The Iowa State Education Association, the National Education Association, and the American Federation of Teachers are wary of environments with limited precautions to protect staff and students. Inevitable reduced class sizes, small groups or pods, will require additional substitute teachers and paraeducators. The American Federation of Teachers doubts funding is forthcoming. An estimated $116.5 billion in supplies and staff to make safety feasible. Trump and U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos have threatened to defund schools that don't open full-time. Yet when Representatives Van Taylor, Republican of Texas, and Josh Harder, Democrat California, asked DeVos to issue guidance and training to educators on reopening schools, she was clueless. Give her another F. Reynolds wants schools, quote, to prioritize in-person learning for core academic subjects, unquote. The legislature, she added, mandated that, quote, most schools cannot provide more than half of their instruction to any student through remote learning, unquote, unless she authorizes it. To that end, the Iowa Department of Education punted to local districts with 10 useless guidelines, including no guarantee exists that, quote, physical distancing can be met in all school settings throughout the entire school day, unquote. Better to look to Europe and Asia, where student groups are small and desks are far apart, lessening the need for personal protective equipment in classrooms. It provided no guidance on face masks other than districts should prevent stigmas, quote, associated with the use or non-use of facial coverings to support a respectful, inclusive, and supportive school environment, unquote. The better recommendation would have used a community's 5% positive testing rate as a common threshold, although 3% is considered ideal. It's been 9.3% since Iowa started testing, but around 6% last week. Temperatures need not be checked at the door. Illinois mandates them. When someone is sick, preventive health changes should be implemented. Appropriate actions aren't cited. Taiwan keeps schools open with one case, but classes with two, which it hasn't had to do. But it closes with two cases, which it hasn't had to do. If someone contracts COVID-19, confidentiality is recommended, but contact tracing is advocated. a tricky legal gauntlet given health privacy rules. Among the no-brainers, ill individuals are advised to stay home and post signs about stopping the spread of COVID-19. Administrators and teachers weren't involved in the process, says Rourke Horn, the former Hudson superintendent now heading the School Administrators of Iowa. Quote, the reopening guidance did not line up with what school leaders were expecting. Administrators were anticipating more specifics for things like social distancing and the use of face coverings, unquote. Said High School Education Association President Mike Baranek, quote, the Iowa Department of Education reopening guidance is inconsistent with the Centers for Disease Control guidance. Common sense and good public policy, we cannot recommend support, unquote. Federal and state officials are eager to score political points by issuing mandates, but stingy with advice or funding. So, with time running out, local school districts must make quick decisions without uniform guidance, while lacking adequate funds for personal protective equipment, more substitute teachers, and paraeducators. They are left to incorporate best practices from overseas studies. But that comes with a caveat, because much of Europe and Asia has flattened the curve, while the U.S. is going in the opposite direction. That was the editorial from today, and the editorial board is comprised of David Adams, general manager, Jackie Smith, North Iowa editor, and Douglas Hines, news editor. We also have a guest column by Saul Shapiro, the retired editor of the Courier living in Cedar Falls. The title of his column, America Can't Get Greater. Trailing by 15 points to a non-charismatic candidate promising four bluster-free years, Donald Trump became a changed man. He donned a mask. He belatedly rediscovered the coronavirus. By the end of June, Trump had made America great again, 10 times greater than the European Union in a 7-day rolling average of 38,200 of new Corona 19 cases compared to 3,700. Charts show U.S. and European Union rates crossing in early April, when the U.S. swoops upward while the European Union plummets and flattens. The EU has banned American visitors. Even ex-EU member Britain makes Americans quarantine upon arrival for 14 days or face $1,200 daily fines. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wouldn't visit Washington to sign the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Pact. Canada booted Toronto, now Pittsburgh Blue Jays, to avoid hosting U.S. baseball teams. Canada's total coronavirus cases equal 2 days in the U.S. With Mexico number four on COVID death charts, its bumbling leftist president Andres Manuel Lopez came to sign the trade deal. Once gone, Trump bragged about his $10 billion wall, which has been easily breached by smugglers using common tools. Quote, it turned out to be very lucky for us that we had the wall, or we would have been inundated because they have some big problems, unquote. Americans still can visit Albania, Dominican Republic, Kosovo, the Maldives, the Mexico, North Macedonia, Serbia, Tunisia, and Turkey. Two dozen other countries will require quarantining. We'll tour America first and only, thanks to a wartime president who surveyed the COVID battlefield and delegated to governors. His buddy, Vladimir Putin, similarly shirked responsibility in Asia. Likewise, Trump embraced the Putin model by dispatching secret police, untrained in demonstrations, according to a Department of Homeland Security memo, to Portland. Uninvited and unwanted, snatching protesters off the streets to bolster his post-bunker law and order image. Trump has even tried to thwart Republicans from getting the COVID job done. Governor Harry Hogan, Republican of Maryland, wrote in the Washington Post about secretly shipping 500,000 test kits into Baltimore from North Korea aboard KAL's only flight ever into BWI to avoid detection. Quote, a caravan of Maryland National Guard trucks escorted by the Maryland State Police drove the tests from the airport to a refrigerated secure warehouse at an undisclosed location. The federal government had recently seized 3 million N95 masks purchased by Massachusetts Republican Governor Charlie Baker. We weren't going to let Washington stop us from helping Marylanders, unquote, he wrote. In Trump land, the solution for dealing with any crisis involving science is bleach and boasting. Hence, the directive for hospitals to cleanse COVID-19 numbers by reporting to a private entity, not the Centers for Disease Control. That was the guest column submitted by Saul Shapiro, retired editor of The Courier, now living in Cedar Falls. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on Sunday, July 26th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. From Cedar Falls, Sharon K. Thayer, 83, died Tuesday, July 21st, at Western Home Communities, Martin Suites. She was born December 6, 1936, in Wichita, Kansas, daughter of Marvin and Christine Travis Thayer. She earned her BA in Health Arts, was a certified registered nurse anesthetist, retiring in 1998, and member of Nazareth Lutheran Church, Cedar Falls. She was preceded in death by a daughter, Jennifer Thomas, a sister, Sue Long, and a brother, Dr. Martin Keith Thayer. Private graveside services in Fairfield Cemetery, Cedar Falls. Richardson Funeral Service is assisting the family of Sharon K. Thayer. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Nazareth Lutheran Church or Habitat for Humanity. Condolences may be left at the website richardsonfuneralservice.com. Mishawaka, Indiana, Alice R. Hamlin, born May 23, 1924, the daughter of Leland and Myrtle Gross Welch. The family relocated to Waterloo. After graduating high school, Alice went to Portland, Oregon to work on World War II ships as a welder. Upon returning to Waterloo, she met the love of her life, James P. Hamlin. The two were married April 5, 1946, at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. He preceded her in death on October 25, 2004. Alice passed away on Thursday, July 2nd. She enjoyed taking annual trips to Vegas to visit family, making baby blankets for expectant mothers, quilting, and tending to her large garden. Alice was a member of the Order of the Eastern Star. She loved reading, sharing her love for reading with others, especially children. Alice was always there for people and loved to help others and support service workers. She's preceded in death by her parents, husband, three sisters, two brothers, an infant son, Billy Lee, and a great-granddaughter, Mariah Jesse. As a tribute to Alice's love for reading, please direct memorials to the Waterloo Public Library in memory of Alice Hamlin. You may direct condolences to the website parrotandwood.com. From Waterloo, Marion Rose Half, 92, died Monday, July 20, at her daughter's home in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She was born January 31, 1928, in Garner, the daughter of Leonard and Carolyn Rayons Prohaska. She married Henry Charles Chuck Half on November 8, 1949, in Duncan, Iowa. He died October 20, 1995. Marion graduated from Garner High School. She worked in credit unions and a number of administrative roles in Waterloo businesses, culminating in her retirement from Members Mutual Oil Company in 1992. She was a beloved member of her Catholic community and involved in the Catholic Daughters, Resurrection Choir, and volunteered as a funeral planner for St. Edward's Church, helping families with funeral preparations at their time of loss. She was a longtime lector and communion minister. As a befriender, Marion delivered communion and homilies to local hospitals, nursing homes, and people unable to attend church services. Marion's strength was in building relationships. She welcomed all as family. Marion's greatest gift was to meet total strangers and treat them as old friends who walked away sharing her gift of love. Such a full life lived with tremendous impact on her family and community. So many lives made better by Marion and such a close family because of her. The person composing the editorial says, Mom's other passions included working in her yard to create a beautiful perennial surrounding that brought joy to herself, family, and friends. There were fresh tomatoes and green beans in summer. A private mass of Christian burial will be on Tuesday, July 28, for Marion R. Hoff, and that'll be at St. Edward's Church, which may be viewed via St. Edward's YouTube channel, www.stedsted.org. Entombment will be in the Mount Olivet Mausoleum, public visitation, 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, July 27th, at Haggerty Weichoff Grerup Funeral Service on South Street, Waterloo. The rosary will be at 4 p.m. with visitation after a vigil service at 7 p.m. There's a limit of 50 people at one time at the funeral home, and social distancing of mass will be required during the visitation. Memorials may be directed to St. Edward's Catholic Church or Columbus High School of Waterloo. Condolences may be left to the Haggerty Weichoff Grafrup website. Virgil M. Lindemann, 96, of Parkersburg, died Friday, July 24, at Unity Point Health in Waterloo of natural causes. Funeral services 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 29, at the Bethel Lutheran Church, with burial in the Oak Hill Cemetery, both in Parkersburg. Visitation 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday at Redmond Schwartz Funeral Home and 1 hour before services at the church. Memorials may be directed to the family of Virgil M. Lindemann. As we mentioned, Redmond Schwartz Funeral Home in Parkersburg is in charge of arrangements, and you may leave condolences at the funeral home's website. From Waterloo, Joanne L. Benda, 76, died Wednesday, July 22nd at home of natural causes. Born January 2nd, 1944 in Cedar Falls, she was the daughter of Thomas and Mary Schaffenberg Stokes. She married Robert Daniel Jones, June 9th, 1962 in Cedar Falls. They later divorced and remained good friends. Joanne later married Cecil Trout in Waterloo. He died December 1st, 1996. She later married Marvin Benda in Cedar Falls. Joanne attended Columbus High School. She was employed as a home health aide housekeeper through her entire adult life. She is preceded in death by her husband Robert Daniel Jones, husband Cecil Trout, a stepson Benjamin Benda, a brother James Stokes, and a sister Diana Helgeson. Memorials may be directed to the family of Joanna L. Benda. A private family service and graveside is planned. The Haggerty Weichoff Grerup Funeral Service on South Street is handling arrangements. Online condolences at that funeral home's website. Burnetta F. Irvine, 84, of Cedar Falls, formerly of Buckingham, died Thursday, July 23rd at the Western home, Thusen Cottage. She was born July 10th to Charles E. and Winnie E. Lunger Worthen in Vinton. Burnetta graduated from Vinton High School in 1954. She married William Willie Irvine on May 25, 1955 at Vinton Presbyterian Church. After marriage, they made their home on the Irvine family farm in rural Buckingham for 46 years. She is survived by his son, Tom, and his spouse, Joe Irvine of Buckingham, two daughters, Kathy and spouse Don Rasmussen of Cedar Falls, and Connie, spouse Harold Crandall of Clinton, a daughter-in-law, Valerie Irvine of Cedar Rapids, her grandchildren, Jeremy and spouse Brandy Crandall, Jen Krause, Jeffrey and spouse Emily Crandall, John and spouse Michaela Rasmussen, Megan and spouse Mitch McAllister, Tricia and spouse Austin Gould, 13 great-grandchildren, many nieces and nephews. Bernetta was preceded in death by her husband of 64 years, Willie Irvine, her son, Mike Irvine, a grandson, Nick Irvine, a sister-in-law, Mary Irvine, her parents, Charles E. and Winnie E. Lunger Good Worthen, and several brothers, sisters, and half-siblings. Services will be private. Burial will be in Buckingham Cemetery near Trayer. Memorials may be directed on behalf of Bernetta F. Irvine to the Western Home, Thusen Cottage, or Unity Point Hospice. Online condolences may be left at dollfuneralhome.com website. Willie and Bernetta enjoyed square dancing, playing cards, and traveling. They took many cruises together, seeing places like Alaska, the Panama Canal, and New Zealand, Australia. They retired to Waterloo in 2001, later moving to the Western Home Communities in 2011. Bernetta was an avid reader, enjoyed puzzle books, cooking and baking, and water aerobics. The family would like to thank the Western Home Communities, Thusen College, and Unity Point Hospice for the love and care they provided Bernetta. Eugene M. Burr, B-U-H-R, 73, of Winthrop, Iowa, died Tuesday afternoon, July 13, in Independence, Iowa. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m. Monday, July 27, at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home, Olwine. Visitation, 3 to 8 p.m. on Sunday, and for 1 hour before the service on Monday at the funeral home. Interment, Floral Hills Memorial Gardens, rural Olwine. Memorials and cards may be directed to the Burr family, 2421 Buffalo Creek Boulevard, Winthrop, Iowa, 50682. Online obituary, Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home for Eugene W., known as Gene Burr. Maxine K. Bright, 87, of Cedar Falls, passed away at Western Home Communities Martin Suites on Tuesday, July 21st. She was born February 28, 1933, in Arlington, Iowa, daughter of Richard Raymond and Anna Thiesfeld Astor. Maxine graduated from Arlington High School with the class of 1951, and her first job was in Washington, D.C. with the FBI. On December 26, 1952, she was united in marriage to William Bill Bright at St. John's Lutheran Church in Arlington. They moved to Cedar Falls, where Maxine worked for Cedar Falls Utilities, eventually become manager of marketing and information services, before retiring in October 1996 with 30 years of service. Maxine was preceded in death by her parents and 9 siblings. Maxine's funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, July 28th, at Nazareth Evangelical Lutheran Church, with visitation prior to services 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. Burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery of Cedar Falls. Attendees are asked to bring and wear a mask and practice social distancing. Memorials may be directed to Christian Crusaders or Cedar Valley Hospice, and condolences may be left at the Dahl Funeral Home website. After retiring, Maxine and Bill enjoyed travel, including visits to Australia, Tasmania, China, Thailand, Alaska, and Maui. They also wintered in Arizona for many years. Maxine was an active member of Nazareth Lutheran Church while her health allowed, and a member of the Altrusa Club since 2000. Eugene A. Bentley, known as Eugene, his full name, Eugene Archie, known as Gene Bentley, 91, of Evansdale. He died July 20th at the North Crest Specialty Care of Waterloo of natural causes. He was born April 22nd, 1929, the son of James Bentley and Mary Nelson. He attended East High School and joined the Army, serving from 1952 to 1954 during the Korean War, where he was a cook. He worked at Rath Packing Company for 35 years before retiring. Gene married Betty Dalton in 1950. They later divorced in 1969. They had two children, Mark Bentley and Michelle Sherwood. Eugene met Faith Niedert in 1992. They enjoyed bingo, camping, fishing, flea markets, auctions, spending time with family and friends. He is preceded in death by his parents, brother Ernie Bentley, and one great-grandson, Brennan. A family-directed service will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family, and you can go to Kern's Funeral Service for more information on Eugene Archie Gene Bentley of Evansdale. Keith A. Young, 70, of Cedar Falls, died Monday, July 20, at Cedar Valley Hospice Home. Born September 2nd, 1949 in Waterloo, Keith was the son of Keith and Donna Rose Young. He married Teresa Terry Saul December 31st, 1981 in Caledonia, Minnesota. Keith graduated from West High School in 1967 and received his BS in Computer Science in 1988. He was employed by UNI for 18 years as the manager of systems programming. A private immediate family memorial service will be at 3 p.m. Tuesday, July 28, at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway. A public visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 28, at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the family and the website HaggertyWaychoffGrarup.com may be visited for condolences. Keith will be remembered for his unique sense of humor and always having a Pepsi nearby. He enjoyed James Bond marathons, watching NASCAR with his wife, or helping his family and friends with home improvement needs. He had a fascination for trains and even hopped aboard one and rode all the way to Vinton. He shared that love with his grandkids, sitting on the floor building tracks with them. Keith always wore jeans and a t-shirt. We encourage visitors to wear jeans or casual dress. Stanley G. Smith, Stanley Gilmore Smith, died July 15th from complications of several kinds of cancer and lymphocytic leukemia, contracted in 2000. He was born in Davenport, Iowa, on the 26th of February, 1930. He was born to John I. and Madeline Bailey Smith. He attended parochial and public schools in Davenport and Muscatine and was a 1948 graduate of Davenport High School. He attended St. Ambrose College, served in the U.S. Army in 1951, and completed his baccalaureate and master's work at Iowa State Teachers College. From the time he was 16, he worked night shifts in factories in the Quad Cities, Waterloo, and Cedar Falls. After graduating, he took a position as technical writer and editor for Chamberlain Corporation in Waterloo. He rose to manager of marketing before retiring in 1992 to operate his own consulting firm, Smith & Friends. He married Irene Auer L. Loudon in Ida Grove, Iowa, on August 16, 1958. She preceded him in death on July 3, 2018. They had four sons, all of whom attended schools in Cedar Falls, and all of whom entered and served in the military. In 1971, he became very active in Cedar Falls politics. He served on the Community Development Block Grant Board, Parks and Recreation Commission, and 24 years as a council member. Before his death, he wrote many newspaper editorials about government affairs. Mr. Smith was well known in the munitions production circles. He authored 5 seminal documents on the state of the ammunition production based in the U.S. and South Korea that were widely circulated in the Department of Defense and Congress. An excellent speaker, he often presented industry's positions to various concerned circles. At his specific request, very specific, there will be no services or celebrations of life. In his words, quote, "Nobody but my immediate family cared when I came into this world. Nobody but my immediate family needs to care about me leaving it," unquote. And that was the obituary for Stanley G. Smith. Mary Ray Lincolnmeyer, 84, of Waterloo, died Friday, July 24th at Ravenwood Specialty Care. She was born August 23rd, 1935, in Independence, the daughter of Raymond C. and Lucille A. McGraw-Hamilton. She married George Lincolnmeyer on March 21st, 1956, in Minnesota. Mary was a waitress at Ramada Hotel for many years. A private family graveside service will be held at a later date, the Haggerty Wachoff Grerup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is handling arrangements. Condolences may be left at the website for Mary Ray Lincolnmeyer. We have a number of other obituaries for which time is not permissive. I will give the names and the time of life of the ones that are listed. Herbert G. Herb Kane, 1924 to 1920. We also have Jeanette Jimmy Ettringer Gray of Waterloo, 1924 to 2020. Jenna L. Bundy, born 1995, died this year on July 20th. We have Lawrence Miller, 1943, born, died on this Arnold Schaap, S-C-H-A-A-P. They don't give any dates and information other than that. Dayton Gage, 2006 to 2020. He was 14 years old. Dorothy E. Cass. She died at the age of 95 on July 23rd. We have Virginia J., known as Ginny Lund. She died in Cedar Falls at the age of 93 on July 19th. And finally, we have Lloyd L. Hofner, 93, died July 24th at his home in Waterloo. In just a few minutes left, we'll read a few headlines that appear on the sports page. And prep football, the Iowa High School Athletic Association details football change, playoffs extended, regular season cut, and it details some of the changes that have been mentioned in trying to develop a football season for the high schools. We have a prep baseball story in Class 1A. The Dons Hogan steps up in state tourney opener. Don Bosco advanced to the fourth 1A semifinal since the 2014 season. In state 2A baseball, Dyke New Hartford set to explore a new diamond. Wolverines continue breakthrough year in the 2A state tournament. I'm going to explore some other headlines here so I can find them. It says you and I football players secure national preseason accolades. They mentioned Ellerson Smith recognized as the FCS National Preseason Defensive Player of the Year during Phil Steele's FCS preseason honors. In Class 1A state softball preview, taking nothing for granted, Clarksville veterans prepared for final trip to Fort Dodge. And in Class 4A State Softball Preview, Comets back on a familiar turf. Charles City set to make fifth straight appearance at state. And I think that's about that's it for most of the local and prep stories. So that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for this Sunday, July 26th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.